This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
We have Palestinian unions that are calling on us to use our language to make explicit stances, and we need to follow through and do the hard thing and stand in solidarity.
Communication Workers of America members speak out on the need for the union to oppose the genocide in Gaza.
So we figured out 15% of our workers are just purely making below the poverty line in terms of wages. So right off the top, 15% of our people are working, going to work every day and coming home without enough money to pay their bills in Sacramento.
We hear from a member of California School Employees Association in Sacramento about the union's ongoing contract negotiations.
Well, there's no emergency. There's no crime emergency. There just isn't. So what is the emergency here? And it happens to coincide with the Trump being put on his back foot in ways we just haven't seen before, including from his base with regards to the Jeffrey Epstein files.
DC-based freelance journalist Pete Tucker speaks about Trump's recent declaration of emergency in the District of Columbia and the ominous agenda of the newest U.S. attorney for the district. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thousands of members of Communication Workers of America met last week in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Several of them talked about the need to stop the genocide in Gaza and the need for national health care as 500,000 health care workers face layoffs due to Medicaid cuts. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with them at the convention.
My name is Autumn Mitchell. I am a member of CWA Local 2108.
And you're here at the convention. There are thousands of other delegates, and there are many issues facing working people here and around the world. What are some of your concerns about issues that need to be addressed?
Right now, I think one of the main issues that needs to be addressed is the fact that there isn't any sort of action being taken on behalf of our union to address the genocide happening in Gaza. I think that we are uniquely positioned to be in support of workers as a union, and it's really important that we show up for workers in Palestine and show up for workers internationally.
And what should the union be saying about this issue? What can the union do about this issue?
I think that first we can start trying to pass resolutions to addressing this issue as a democratic organization. We could start there. I mean, baby steps, right? I think that we can pool ourselves collectively to push back against companies who are funding war in Gaza and funding genocide in Gaza. I personally am somebody who works in the tech industry, and there's quite a lot of funding for weapons of war that workers don't have to be compliant with. We don't have to be okay with that. We can take a stand and address that.
And tech workers have organized, tech workers against apartheid.
That's right.
And they're very angry about the fact that their labor is going to something that they feel is wrong.
Yes.
What's been going on with that, and why are tech workers getting organized around that?
So as an example, No Azure for Apartheid is an organization of people working within Microsoft who have had enough of the Azure suite being utilized for funding genocide in Gaza. And essentially what's happening is people within Microsoft are getting together and doing demonstrations and taking a stand and sending emails and trying to educate people on how the labor that we are contributing to Microsoft and to Azure is directly assisting in humanitarian crisis.
And also the government is now collaborating with these companies around spying on Palestinians, and also the right of privacy for Americans. Is that a concern you have?
Yeah, of course. I think a lot of tech companies in particular consider themselves to be advocates for privacy, but if history is any indicator, we all know how that tends to go when you let, you know, private sector decide how to run things and it's not regulated, it tends to go south.
And IBM, during the First World War, before it was actually working with Germany in the concentration camps, providing technical ability.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, we need to learn from history, right, folks? So talking about it, getting involved, trying to pass resolution. I mean, we are more than capable of doing it. We've been advocating for workers for a very, very long time.
My name is Jessie Lease. I am on the bargaining committee for the ZeniMax Workers United, CWA.
This genocide is a terrible thing, and you personally felt it.
I think that when we're talking about your normal duties that you have to show up for, when you start to take the time to educate yourself, something that I did is I read Omar Ellicott's book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. I highly recommend it. And after really taking in a lot of the media from Palestinian journalists and the constant barrage of the live stream genocide that we're seeing take place, it becomes impossible to work. It becomes impossible to do normal things, because how can you continue contributing to capitalism when you know that you're behind this, you're funding this, when your labor is being used for these nefarious purposes? You can't work the same way. And it was hard for me to still show up to my 9-to-5 job with the same level of gusto for completing my daily tasks, because you know the pipeline at that point in time. I was still showing up to my union meetings with the same level of gusto, because you can see the connections there between community and organizing, and how we're able to raise awareness on a larger scale for everything human rights related when we're doing that. But normal work tasks, how do you continue to function? Entire bloodlines are being decimated before our eyes, and it's intentional.
And the union should do something about this?
Yes, the union, CWA needs to have really explicit stances, I believe, about Palestine. And we need to stand with the people of the world when they're suffering. We have Palestinian unions that are calling on us to use our language to make explicit stances. And we need to follow through and do the hard thing and stand in solidarity. Solidarity is not supposed to be easy.
Corey Gambini, and I'm president of CWA Local 1168 in Buffalo, New York.
It seems that, I mean, the United States, one budget item that did go up was military spending. While military spending is going up, they're cutting social services, they're cutting education. It seems, and a lot of people, even supporters of Trump, are angry that the United States is spending all this money overseas and people here are suffering.
Absolutely. I agree. I mean, we're going to dismantle our whole healthcare system. I'm president of a local that represents healthcare workers in CWA. And, you know, we, right from the Medicaid cuts, we already started closing services. I'm getting calls while I'm here that they're announcing closures of services because of the impending Medicaid cuts.
500,000 workers in healthcare may lose their jobs.
Right. But we're sending all that money to commit genocide. I mean, it's crazy. So,
and I mean, like 500,000 workers of many different unions, SEIU, CWA, AFSCME, it seems like even those unions that are being affected massively by Medicaid cutbacks are not uniting. There's no unity action by all the unions that are being affected by Medicaid.
I think fascism does this, they create chaos, right? There is so much being thrown at us and so much going on that you really can't even keep up with stuff. So I agree, we will definitely, I think, I work very closely with the SEIU, Local 1199 in Buffalo, New York. We bargain contracts together for our healthcare workers. So I think that we'll be talking about putting, you know, groups together that we, I mean, we've got to get aligned on this stuff. Labor does. There is labor groups, members that are part of labor groups that are trying to unify. I've been a big stance on universal healthcare because we have so many fights over healthcare coverage in our contracts, where if we could have universal healthcare, we wouldn't, that money can then go into wages and benefits for our members.
Well, the News Guild passed a resolution for single payer for national healthcare, but it seems like it wasn't even brought up at the convention. I mean, it was the president, Claude Cummins, said we need cheaper healthcare. I don't really see that as the problem. Is the fact the money is going to the insurance companies, not to healthcare.
Oh yeah, they're making billions in profits. And
United Healthcare using AI to
deny stuff day to day, taking care of patients and the care that they get, and the staffing problems that we have, because there's actually way too much money in healthcare. It's just not at the bedside.
Those were the voices of Communication Workers of America members who were meeting at their national convention in Pittsburgh. The national leadership opposed an open debate on any resolution opposing the U.S.-supported genocide in Gaza, and also opposed debating a resolution on single-payer health care.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody know. Yeah. Everybody know. I'm asking you, who's something now? Who's something now? Who's something now? I'm asking you, who's something now? Who's something now? Who's something now? Over territory for the dominion, who will dominate the opinion, schisms and isms, keeping us informed of religion conforming our vision to the world church's decision, trapped in a section, submitted to committee election, moral infection, epidemic lies and deception, insurrection of the highest possible order, distort not take recorders from hearing like underwater, beyond the borders, fond of sin and disorder, bound by the strategy and systemic depravity, heavy as gravity, head first in the cavity without a bottom, fate, worse than Sodom, what's got
him? Lauryn Hill, Freedom Time. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Pacifica Radio contributor Fatima Garcia in Sacramento, California, interviewed Sean Frame, a member of California School Employees Association, CSEA, Chapter 480, for a conversation on the union's ongoing contract negotiations.
Today, we have a union steward from CSEA, Chapter 480. Please welcome Sean Frame to the show.
Thank you for having me here.
Let's start at the beginning. For listeners who might not be familiar, what is CSEA Chapter 480 and who do you represent?
So CSEA, California School Employees Association, is a union made up of the employees at schools and school districts and county offices of education and even community colleges who do the work that doesn't require a teaching certificate. So that's a lot of different things. In our particular one, Chapter 480 at the Sacramento County Office of Education, we have 63 job classifications from everything from custodial and maintenance workers, paraeducators who work in the classroom with severely handicapped students, office workers like myself, I'm a multimedia designer, accounting technicians, payroll people, librarians. I mean, it's a wide range of people represented in a classified union. And if I could, I'll give you a little history of how CSEA got started, because it's kind of an interesting story.
Yes, please. Sure.
In 1927, so almost 100 years ago, some janitors in Oakland were talking amongst themselves, and they realized that one of their coworkers, I believe her name was Mary, had worked for 35 years and did not have a pension. And they thought that was unacceptable. And it was at a time when, you know, other workers did in fact have pensions, defined benefit plans for retirement, but many of the lower wage workers like custodial workers did not have that. And so they formed a union with just a simple idea of, let's have a pension so one day we can retire. Wow, what a concept, right? And we're still fighting those battles today, by the way, we know that, but that's how it got started, and we're coming up on our 100th anniversary as a union.
The importance of actually listening to everyday workers' intelligence of what they need to make their conditions better is very admirable on how CSEA started. So thank you for sharing that history. What impact do these workers have on our community here in our region?
Well, you know, the work that many of us, 40% of the workers that we have in our chapter are paraeducators. And at a county office of education, what paraeducators exclusively do is provide the special ed services in the classroom. So there are classroom teachers who also are union workers there, but they're certificated. So these are the people who sort of run the classroom. But the people who really work one-on-one, often with the students, are paraeducators. And they will provide food, that they'll feed students through feeding tubes, for example. They will change them. They will change their diapers. They will often give them their medicine that they need. And they will also work with them on some of their behavioral plans, et cetera. So there's a lot of the real hands-on work in those classrooms for some of our most vulnerable students is done by my union siblings. And The sad truth of it is, you know, and this is one of the big struggles that we have, and they'll tell you this all the time, is two things. One, They work 6.5 hours per day. Why 6.5 hours? That seems like a very specific number. Well, if they were to work 7 hours, they would receive FMLA benefits. So they can't let them work 7 hours. And the other part of it is they are paid, even after a very good raise that we got them, only slightly better than somebody flipping burgers down the street. And I think that the work that they do is significantly more important. I'm not denigrating the work of anybody, right? Like, everybody's work has dignity. I'm not saying somebody flipping burgers doesn't deserve 20 an hour. They probably deserve more than that too. What I am saying though is somebody who works one-on-one with a student who is their, becomes their lifeline in the school system ought to be given the dignity of being able to work a single job to be able to maybe get sick and not look at financial ruin for doing so. For example, I think those are just basic dignities that everybody should have. And certainly some of our workers who are being denied them intentionally.
I still find it really difficult to believe that workers are fighting for basic dignity and living wages and working conditions in 2025, especially when we have survived a pandemic and an economy. And, you know, right now with all of the privatization happening in our public sector, how has CSEA members stepped up during particularly difficult times such as emergency budget cuts and pandemics recent years?
So during the pandemic, I mean, if you think about it, our members were the ones first back into the classrooms. They were also responsible for cleaning the classrooms, right? Because, you know, what happened when we started sending kids back, the first thing that happened was we put in all these protocols about cleaning. That increased the workload of our custodial maintenance workers significantly. The maintenance workers had to put in all these barriers and all the, you know, PPE and all these things. And then the custodial staff had to literally go in multiple times a day and clean surfaces and, you know, do all this additional work and do it in an environment where they were most likely to get the, you know, to contract COVID. So it was a very challenging time for our members. And one thing I will say is that there was a brief moment where the administration recognized the importance of our contributions because they were not going to go into those classrooms and do that work. So they understood and put themselves and their families in danger. I, in fact, did contract COVID in a classroom setting. So I can tell you from personal experience that my family directly was impacted by the fact that I was sent back to a classroom in a school where the students were not forced or the mask rules were not enforced. And I walked into that school environment thinking that I was protected by the rules of my workplace. And I was told, no, the rules of our workplace dictate your safety. And I had to decide whether I was going to walk off the job or take the risk. And I took the risk and I shouldn't have. So I could tell you from firsthand experience that those times were very challenging for classified workers. But and at least the administration paid lip service to the fact that they appreciated what we did. I'm not sure what they felt in their heart, but, you know.
It is devastating to know that, you know, essential workers during a pandemic were not taken care of, valued, and protected. Thank you for all the work that you guys continue to do. So you are currently in a contract negotiation. What are some of the key issues you're advocating for at the bargaining table? You're also a part of the bargaining unit, right? Tell us more about how that process is moving forward or not.
Well, this is a non-successor year. So they want us to do 3-year contracts at Sacramento County office. It's kind of unprecedented. In a past life, well, part of this, my life, right? I was a school board member. I was actually on the other side of the table. So I've seen this from both sides. And in that situation, we were dealing with 1-year contracts and a 3-year successor where you could open up the whole contract and look at things that needed to be fixed. But the finance was done every year. At the Sacramento County office, it had been tradition long before I was there that it was a 3-year contract. And when I got there and I looked at that, the first thing I said to myself was, this union needs to be organized because we should not be accepting 3-year contracts in the uncertain world we work in and locking in our financial increases without knowing, for example, that one of the 3 years there was going to be 10% inflation and we were going to get a 2% raise. And that actually did happen. But that moment was a galvanizing moment for our members. Because they said, wait a minute, They were told at the table, by the way, if things change and you want to come back and ask for more at some point, you are welcome to do that. So we did. We went back and we said, look, inflation is 10%. We're getting 2%. Our members are going backward in a very meaningful way. It's making them housing insecure. It's making it so that people cannot run their air conditioning in the summer or their heat in the winter because they can't afford the bills. It is making it difficult for people to fill up their car with gas to get them to work. And, you know, they basically said, sorry, you agreed to that three-year deal. So we went back to the table the next time. We said, we're never taking 3 years again. And we took a two-year deal. The certificated staff and the administration took 3 years. And the third year was yet another 2% raise. At that time, we said, and our members told us very clearly, we will not accept 2%. And we told them at the table, there's no reason for us to take the third year because our members will never settle if that's in the contract. If that's in our tentative agreement, we're going all the way. Like they will not stop. So we made it very clear. And we've been sitting there for at least the last 2 years knowing that this day would come and fearing the worst, which is that we would come back and they would offer us the same 2% again. And that is exactly what they did. But they went one step further. They took every single other item that we brought to negotiate, things that were very fair, some things that didn't even have financial impact. We asked for, you know, Cesar Chavez day off, which is, by the way, it's a state holiday. We should be able to have that day off. And they said, no. They said, in fact, anything that has any financial impact whatsoever is off the table. You can't talk about it. And I said, that's pretty much everything if you want to, you know, extrapolate a little bit. Then they immediately turned around and brought something to us that had financial impact for our members. And we said, I'm pretty sure you just said you didn't want to talk about anything that had financial impact. And that's how the negotiations started. And that led us to the point where we are now, where we are, they have tendered us a 2% offer and no changes to our contract. And we are now in a fight, but it's a galvanizing moment again for our members. We as a negotiating team don't go in there, you know, as high and mighty negotiators with our big ideas. We poll our members. We talk with them. Every time I'm out at a representation and I see something wrong with the contract, I'm making notes. And then I'm bringing that back to the members and saying, hey, you guys seeing this too? We're having a conversation about this long before we ever get to the table. Because I want to know, and our team needs to know at the table, what our members want and need, what they will accept and will not accept. And we need to be their voice. In fact, many times, if I were just to look at my own self-interest, what I'm advocating for is not always the best for me. But if the members have spoken to me and said, this is what we have to have, that's what I'm going to fight for at the table.
I really love the activation to collective action through these contract negotiations. I think it's so critical for the labor movement and all workers, regardless of having a union or not, to move into collective action right now under the circumstances that we're living. Why are these demands like fair wages, benefits, or safe working conditions so critical right now for CSEA?
Well, you know, they're always critical, but I think for our members, we figured out 15% of our workers are just purely making below the poverty line in terms of wages. So right off the top, 15% of our people are working, going to work every day and coming home without enough money to pay their bills in Sacramento. So what does that do? Well, it pushes them out further, makes their commute longer, which then increases their gas bill. Like, it's not a very good treadmill to be on. But so that's part of it. You know, step two, as I mentioned earlier, some of our workers will work 6.5 hours. That is just enough time out of your day to make it very difficult to go to a second job, right? Like if you were working 4 hours, it might be easier to pick up an 8-hour shift and work 12. And people do that, right? But to work 6.5, and by the time you get home, maybe you're 7.5. And now you're going to go work another 8-hour job. Now you're working 16. What about your family? What about the you know, what about time to eat? What about time to rest? So these demands, you know, really are just about making sure that our members have their head above water. And we know that these tariffs and other things that are happening at the national level are going to impact our members most acutely, because anytime there's a tax that is a tax, you know, on your daily consumption, on the things that you can't get around buying, food, gas, heat, light, you know, the basics, right? every time that tax is imposed on people, it hurts working people more. And so that's in these times and in all times, until such time as we are all working above the poverty line, right? And I would say significantly above would be the right place. We're going to be in this struggle. So that's an all time. I mean, that's independent of this administration. And I say it, I'm not afraid to just look at our administrators who are making $250,000, $300,000, $350,000 a year and say to them, it is immoral that you make that much at an agency where some people are housing insecure.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I think it's very important to understand the dynamics within management, those in decision-making leadership positions that can improve the living conditions of SEA. With that being said, tell us about the structure. What is the number of in your bargaining unit and management? Can you tell us the dynamics of how the top-bottom structure or bottom-up structure is for CSEA?
Well, it's very different at every school site, right? I know, it's really dependent upon what your school or your district or your county office of education looks like. Sacramento County Office of Education is very unique because we sit within, eyesight of the Capitol. So when the California Department of Education is looking for educators to implement new programs, to test out ideas, they come to our office very often with those plans, right? With that money. And that's usually in the form of a grant. And as we know, grants don't typically support long-term infrastructure, right? Like the grant is there and then and money runs out and either it gets renewed or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then they are supposed to, then those jobs go away, right? As soon as the grant goes away, the jobs go away because the grant created the jobs. So that's how our office kind of is funded. We're more grant funded than any other, but every grant that we get, about almost 9%, 8.9% of every grant dollar that we get goes into our general fund and has built up an enormous reserve. We have probably the highest reserves of any local educational agency in the state, other than places like Beverly Hills and Tiburon and very wealthy school districts. And so we have this big pile of money we're sitting on that has allowed the management class to grow. So they will tell you, and I say it to them, and they get very angry. I say, the classified unit, we have about 300 employees. We've had 300 employees as long as I've been there, and they're not adding new classified positions. In fact, if things go wrong in a year, they're probably going to be trying to reduce our staff. Meanwhile, when I started there, there were about 180 managers. There are now 324 managers. There are more managers than there are workers. Some of my coworkers have 3 and 4 people who claim to be their manager, even though the org chart clearly says, like, this person over here is. That person who is on the org chart may never even see them or know what they do. And then there are 3 levels of management below them who are telling, giving contradictory information to our workers. It's unreal. And there are 129 managers who make more than our highest paid member. Let me repeat that. So our highest paid member is here, and there's 129 people above them who are all managers in terms of what they get paid. And that's in an agency of 770 people. So unions will always say, our agency is top heavy. And they're not lying, but I just think, like, there's top heavy and then there's SCOE, which is just like insanely top heavy. Like, I don't know how that they could justify that. And so that's one of our struggles, right? That's one of the battles, and we're working on that. That's a structural problem we got to fix, and I've got ideas on that, and we are actually making an effort on that. But because, look, let's be clear. When all that money is going to the top, there is not much left for the bottom. Like, they love to say, oh, we're family. I'm like, okay, so let's look at this like a family dinner, right? And you ordered enough pizza for everybody. But before we even walked into the room, you took half of the pizza or more, 2/3 of the pizza, and walked away with it. And then we walk in, we're like, it's a pizza party. Everybody split those pieces into thirds. Okay, that's my family? Like, I'm going to be outraged, right? Like,
Yeah, I mean, these numbers are significant in contrast to the actual people who are hands-on doing the work and having a ripple effect in our communities because they're taking care of our most vulnerable. And so it's important to get that funding to the workers who are actually on the ground in the field taking care of the most vulnerable students in public education.
Yeah, and I should give a shout out, and I didn't mention it, but I should. One of the most important things that our members do is work with the justice-involved youth in our community. So, if a student ends up in the system, they are still allowed and do get an education, and they are able to, for example, get their high school equivalency even if they're in the system when they would have graduated from high school. And it's our members, for the most part, who are working with them to get their services. There might be one teacher in there, but for every one teacher, we're going to have five transition specialists who are helping them connect to the services they need, helping them get connected to community college if they get their equivalency and want to move on, helping them find out housing resources, because when they get out of the system, a lot of times they'll find that their family is not there for them anymore. Maybe their family was never there for them, right? And that might be why they're in the system. So it's our members who are working with those justice-involved youth and helping them hopefully come back into society in a way that won't have them back in the system. And again, that's a job that pays barely above the living wage requirement for our region. But the people who do that work do it because they believe it is important work to do in our community.
These resources are so important when we are seeing all of the defunding from this administration of the service to help and support and mentor our youth that is in such great need, especially when we live in a country who is invested in mass incarceration. So thank you for highlighting that. It's so critical. How can the community support CSEA during these negotiation periods?
Well, the first thing that people can do is show up to the board meetings and just speak out on our behalf. I think that, I would love to say that we have this massive strike fund, and the day that our successor agreement is open and we go past the date, that we're going to be out there in the streets and on strike. But I'll be honest with you, when I'm talking about, it's just simply not possible, right? We don't have the strike funds because we can't charge local dues that are enough to build those strike funds. Because if we did, our members would be suffering even more. And so, they know we're not going on strike, and we know we're not going on strike. So what we need, though, is the community. Like, if people were there telling the Board of Education, telling the superintendent, telling the administration there that they are watching, that they would like to see people who do this important work given the dignity of being able to work a single job, being able to go home and spend time with their families, instead of work going to a second or a third job. That would be the most important thing you can do. And if you can't make it to our Board of Education meetings, which are on Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. At the main office in Mather, write a letter to the Board of Education and just tell them that you value our members and what we provide to students, to families, and to our community, and that you feel like people who do this kind of work ought to be valued in this at least equivalent way to the value they provide. And because I think that scrutiny, right, is and it, these are public employees we're talking about, right? This isn't a private corporation where they can just say, our shareholders want all the money and it's nothing we can do. This is our money. This is our money. How we spend that money is a reflection of the values that we have. And if you believe, like I do, that the people doing this work have value, then you need to make it clear that that's the priority you want our public employees, our elected officials. Those are the priorities you want them to have.
Great. Thank you, Sean. And last question. If you could send one message to local leadership and the public about what your members deserve, what would it be?
It's a single word. It's dignity. There is no dignity in going to your job knowing that if you get sick, you are going to lose your job. There is no dignity in going to your job and then going to a second job and a third job and abandoning your own family because you have to make enough money to keep a roof over their head. the people who do this work just deserve the dignity of what we all want, which is to be able to go in and do our job and to have a life beyond our job. So that's what I would say.
That leaves us with like a moral compass to be able to uplift and also our humanity, right? I think it's critical for us to see each other as humans, living people trying to exist in this capitalist world. Thank you again, Sean, for joining us. We appreciate the work you and CSEA Chapter 480 do every day. As always, it's the voices closest to the struggle that hold the clearest vision of justice.
Well, thank you, Fatima. It's been so amazing to have this conversation with you. I think it's important in this time where, you know, the labor movement is not forefront in the way it was at one time, for people to hear what the labor movement can do for people, you know, and to understand what the struggles are. Like, the sad thing is, I think if you asked an average person on the street, like, hey, how's your work life? You know, most people are going to tell you it's not very good, right? And so the notion that we collectively can achieve more is an important message in these times.
Solidarity, Sean. Solidarity.
Solidarity.
That was Sean Frame, California School Employees Association, Chapter 480 member, speaking to Fatima Garcia, Pacifica contributor in Sacramento, California, also with El Pueblo Platica.
Señor presidente, le vengo a avisar, no tengo papeles para trabajar. Señor presidente, pregunto por qué matan al moreno con piel de café. Si fuera presidente, honestamente, si fuera presidente, para mi gente, si fuera presidente, honestamente, si fuera presidente, para mi gente.
If I was president, I'd roll up my sleeves as I face the congregation. First thing I do is free education. And every third period, yo, we practice meditation. Like a brown Robin Hood, I'd take from the rich and I'd give to the poor. So my little sister ain't gotta be hungry no more. And my first lady would be my mom's, cause she'd smack me at the first start of drone strikes and dropping bombs. And if I was president, I'd free all my poor black and brown kids that got caught up in three strikes. And when they get out, they get three bites, so they can ride to their future, not to their past. Go to the store, get some chips with no GMO, cause my folks, we got a right to know. And if you don't know, now you know. Me gusta la lima, me gusta el limón, pero no me gusta tanta corrupción.
That was Las Cafeteras singing If I Was President. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Next, Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke speaks to D.C.-based freelance journalist Pete Tucker about Trump's recent declaration of emergency in the District of Columbia and the ominous agenda of the newest U.S. attorney for the district.
Pete Tucker, what are your thoughts on the current state of emergency in the District of Columbia as declared by President Trump last week, today being Friday, 15 August?
Well, President Trump has made clear that he wants to use D.C. as an example, and he's more able to do that than elsewhere because D.C. isn't a state, and so that gives him some unique powers. D.C. has had a home rule for over 50 years, and so it's significantly self-governs and taxes its residents and is in charge of its local affairs, but the federal government can and infrequently steps in, certainly not in this way. And Trump has taken over DC police for 30 days. He wants it for more than that. He has brought in 800 DC National Guard, and president is the only of the, there's 50 states obviously, but DC is the only National Guard. It has a National Guard, but actually Trump is in control, so he can just do that. And he's flooded an additional 500 federal law enforcement officers, FBI and the like, into the streets of DC, and they're going around clearing homeless encampments, getting people for immigration violations, and beautifying the city. It feels like, you know, with all this military presence and the beautification, it just feels like a real takeover of a local democracy. And again, this is an example that Trump wants to export. And he said where he wants to export this to. He's named L.A., Chicago, Baltimore, New York, D.C., and I'm forgetting, there might be one other. All of them are cities with black mayors. All of them overwhelmingly voted against Trump. And I think this is scary stuff. And I saw today, and of course, Trump has already brought a federal presence into LA against the wishes of Karen Bass, the mayor there. I saw an article today in which Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, was speaking, and Customs and Border Patrol had, I don't know, a couple dozen officers outside of, they amassed a couple dozen officers outside of where he was speaking. There was no reason for that. But this is the type of thing that a strong man would do, to have, you know, your own kind of personal army that you send and direct. And so, yeah, I think this is a dangerous precedent, and that once it's established, Trump is certainly, if he gets away with it, certainly I don't think this is going to be the last time we see this. And we've already seen it in LA and DC. So yeah, scary stuff.
Are you surprised at the degree of cooperation and acceptance of Trump's actions that are being met by official Washington? That is the mayor, Muriel Bowser, chief of police, Pamela Smith, and as well as liberal media that includes both MSNBC and the Washington Post.
With regards to Mayor Muriel Bowser and the chief of police, I think that I want to step back and just look at it broadly and say that no mayor or every mayor has a job to do, which is get the trash picked up, you know, the schools, jobs, and yes, policing, which is the excuse that Trump has used, saying that D.C. is suffering an epidemic of crime like nothing that's ever seen before, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, serious crime in D.C. is at a 30-year low, and crime is down in all the cities that he is targeted. But that's the excuse. And then with regards to Bowser, how she's responded, I just want to step back and say the mayor's job are the things that I just mentioned. It's not to have to deal with troops being brought in against your wishes onto your streets. And that is, to me, the first, second, and third thing of importance here. It is not acceptable to bring troops into a city against the wishes of the mayor. And now how the mayor has to, you know, respond to that, you know, no mayor should have to. And so I'll hold most of my thoughts about, you know, what I would hope that she did or didn't do, to the fact that I really hope that this precedent isn't accepted, where a president can do what Trump is doing to DC. Now, with regards to how the media has responded, in particular the Washington Post, the Post has done some good news reporting on what Trump is up to. What I've been focused on is the opinion page, which has been recently transformed. The Post is owned by Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, and he has his space company, Blue Origin. And Bezos, well, initially when he bought the Post, he just kind of was hands off and kept it going as it was. But he really made an about face shortly before this last election. He personally intervened to spike the Post planned endorsement of Kamala Harris. In fact, it had been drafted. The Democratic nominee that Trump was up against. He has taken other really extraordinary measures, and he's also he and Amazon have lavished tens of millions of dollars on Trump and his family. And Bezos has also said, "Look, we are going to only publish, pro-American, pro-free market ideas on the opinion page." And now it's headed up by someone, a 33-year-old named Adam O'Neill. And there's just been a purge through buyouts, generous buyouts, and unprecedented numbers of people at the Post have left. So you've lost a lot of institutional knowledge. And the result is a right-wing shift. And I was a critic of the Post from shortly before I came to D.C. But this is really extraordinary. And the result has been, even as the Post covers what Trump is doing, the opinion pages, the editorials have been kind of wishy-washy, in the sense that they're not saying, yes, this is a good thing, but they're like, yeah, well, crime is a real problem. And again, crime is at a serious crime is at a 30-year low in DC. It is declining. The idea that Trump could establish an emergency based on crime is totally unacceptable. This is authoritarian. This is racist. He's only going after cities with black mayors and significant minority populations that overwhelmingly didn't vote for him. And rather than just drawing the line there and calling that out, you see column after column, editorial being like, yeah, well, crime really is a big problem. One columnist said it's like cancer. You know, just because you have a little doesn't mean it's a good thing. And again, that's the excuse, the justification that Trump is using to do this authoritarian racist action. And so then you, by agreeing with the premise that we really need to focus on crime, you are in effect helping pave the way for these extraordinary measures that he's taken. So I am deeply concerned with what I've seen from the opinion pages of the Post.
Okay. Just a point of clarification. The Washington Post is still a publicly traded company?
It's not.
No. Bezos, he bought controlling shares and privatized it?
I can't remember if it was publicly traded under the Graham family.
Pretty sure it was.
It was?
Yeah. Yeah.
So then he took it private, yeah, when he bought it.
You know, Washington Post Company, they own Newsweek and some other, they were starting to get into education.
Didn't just start to get into education. At the end of the run, Don Graham, who headed up the company, said, "We are an education and media company."
Yes.
Education first. That's where all the money was coming in. We could talk more about that. But since 2013, I think it is, Bezos has outright owned the Post himself personally.
Okay, thank you. Kentucky Republican, libertarian, and somewhat maverick Congressman Thomas Massie posted earlier this week on X this question: why is Trump sending troops to D.C. to fight crime during the recess? All the criminals went home to their districts. I'd note that a large group actually went to Israel to get themselves photographed at the Wailing Wall or at a settlement in the West Bank, in a full-throated support for America's geostrategic cat-paw enforcer, Zionist Israel. But Massie does point out the timing of Trump's moves here in the district. What strikes you when it comes to the timing of this domestic offensive by Trump's administration?
Well, there's no emergency. There's no crime emergency. There just isn't. So what is the emergency here? And it happens to coincide with the Trump being put on his back foot in ways we just haven't seen before, including from his base, with regards to the Jeffrey Epstein files. Is that why he's doing it? I don't know. But it's certainly, Trump's MO is he escalates and hits you with more and more things. And so I don't think that this is, and others like Brandon Scott, the mayor of Baltimore being one of the cities targeted by Trump, said, when you have this bad jobs numbers that came out, and then you have the Jeffrey Epstein stuff, it's not a coincidence that you're then targeting these cities. So it strikes me as certainly a coincidence, if not the reason, for Trump's actions, that he is, in ways we just haven't seen before, really flailing when it comes to explaining his tight relationship years long with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein.
Trump's newly appointed U.S. attorney for the district, Judge Jeanine Pirro, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday, the 14th of August, calling for the repeal of several laws, giving some possibilities for leniency for convicted persons younger than 25, as well as advocating for treating accused youth as young as 14,
yep,
as adults rather than youth. What are your thoughts on that and sort of interference in D.C. laws? And
you know, it's funny to be hearing Jeanine Pirro's name. I grew up in Westchester, New York, and she was the elected district attorney for a decade or so in Westchester. And then she became a, you know, right-wing, you know, Fox News personality for years. And, you know, now Trump has just brought her in recently, confirmed, I think, as U.S. attorney for D.C.
Was she a state, New York state judge as well?
I believe she was a judge as well, yeah. She knows nothing about D.C. Nothing, you know? And so to be coming in with these talking points about charging 14-year-olds as adults and, you know, these are all decisions that D.C. officials, that, you know, the D.C. council, the mayor, should have a say in. They're closer to, you know, and it's a democracy. They've been elected. And then even, you know, you work at D.C. is unique in that it's actually the federal U.S. attorney that handles the court system. So you're always going to have, you already have extraordinary federal intervention. But that Jeanine Pirro wants to just overturn what local elected officials do, I mean, we don't have a perfect democracy, God knows, you know, in D.C. But Jeanine Pirro from Westchester is not going to make it better. And then to come in and just start trying to overturn what the D.C. council and mayor have done is extraordinary. And the other thing I would say is that op-ed that you mentioned, Thomas, you know, a former Post editor spoke to an outlet called Status and said this would not have run under prior opinion chiefs before Adam O'Neill, this really unknown 33-year-old who heads up the opinions department at the Post now. This would not have run, that they're turning the page into a pro-Trump bullhorn. You know, it's a extraordinary moment at this crisis for the city to have this, the D.C.'s paper of record give such, and they put it right at the top of the homepage, Jeanine Pirro's op-ed, which again goes after D.C. for, you know, this extraordinary runaway horrible crime, which is not the case. 30-year low when it comes to, you know, violent crime. No one's saying it's perfect. There's no place in this violent country that is. But they're pinning it at the top of the homepage. They're giving Jeanine Pirro, you know, this valuable space to make the case, essentially, for what Trump is doing, this authoritarian move. So I'm disturbed that Jeanine Pirro is the U.S. attorney for D.C. I'm disturbed at the valuable real estate the Post gave her to justify what Trump is doing.
That was Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke speaking to journalist Pete Tucker in part one of their discussion of recent and past events in the District of Columbia. Pete's writing can be found at fair.org and petetucker.substack.com. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Fatima Garcia, Steve Zeltzer, and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.